My view, there are several things which a Hillel Foundation should do. The major objective is to make being Jewish intellectually exciting, culturally respectable, and to a great degree religiously acceptable, religiously appropriate. Let me take the easy one first, religious appropriateness. By and large, the community synagogues have very little interest in students at the various universities in Oakland or Duquesne. That is an unfortunate decision, since the young students at universities would probably be an appropriate transition for the older daughters, the daughters in their junior and senior high schools, for the members of the synagogue. But that is a decision which the synagogues have to worry about, and with the exception, it seems to me, of Beth Sholem, the synagogues do not worry very much about young people in the adolescent years. Secondly, insofar as the observant Jews, those who are Shomar Shabbat, Shomar Kosher, and even observe the less well-known 613 precepts, such as fringes on the garment and other things, are concerned, they will define their own group. The real problem, it seems to me, is to go to Jews from conservative backgrounds, particularly left-wing conservative backgrounds, and Reform Jews, and expose these young people to the kinds of things that I have mentioned. They should be come to realize that Judaism is intellectually a very exciting religion. It is exciting in many senses. Professor Seymour Drescher, who is the university professor of history, brings a great many Jewish references into his lectures. When I was teaching, I was told that a student description of my courses often remarked that I told a great many Bible stories, many of which seemed to be sexually rather provocative. The question of method of learning, which is very much tied up with understanding the techniques used in Talmudic argumentation, many students find very exciting. The question of the differences between the points in the Old Testament and the New Testament, my students always found rather interesting. I used to point out to them that in the Old Testament, man was compared with animals. In the New Testament, man was compared with God. In both cases, men were inadequate, but the relative inadequacy was more interesting in the case of the Old Testament than in the case of the New Testament. And it seems to me that one of the things which Hillel Foundation should do is to try to stress that. Another thing it seems to me that they might do is to explain the great varieties of interpretation in the exegesis of the Old Testament. I digress, but I wish to make my point. I do not recall whether I mentioned my desire to have the Jewish Studies program at the University of Pittsburgh focus mainly on criticism, biblical criticism of the Old Testament. It is a tremendously rich area, and it seems to me it is almost impossible for a student, Jewish or non-Jewish, not to be overwhelmed by the richness of the interpretation. it is impossible, it seems to me, for them to discuss or to hear about Moses' confrontation with a burning bush and recognize that the divine answer, I am that I am, is a tremendous insight into the critical importance of the verb to be. It is a unique verb. It is a unique verb in the sense that it is almost impossible to exhaust its depth. On the other hand, the remarkable thing about the Old Testament is not the being but the becoming, which is the only way one can possibly understand such patriarchal figures as Abraham or Jacob. Both of them were hardly men of extraordinary probity. Yet, the interesting question is, what is their theological significance? Well, in any case, that's the sort of thing which I think many students would find interesting. Instead, too many efforts at the Hillel Foundation follow the lead of Philip Siegel, that is, a discussion of current topics. It is as though there is a Jewish way to regard politics. Obviously, most people believe it is a liberal way. But this is nonsense. At least to my mind, it is nonsense. Every Jew wants to be a prophet, it seems. But it is quite clear, if one examines both the Tanakh and the Talmud, the gift of prophecy is not a self-assumed. There should be a great deal of discussion under what situations do you claim the gift of prophecy. I'm always impressed with the famous comment of by Lincoln to the effect that the question is not on whose side is God, but are we on God's side? And that is, it seems to me, a desirable lesson. My major concern about the Hillel Foundation, of course, now comes to the high rate of intermarriage. In my generation, most of us married Jews because there was very little option. In my own case, I suppose I could have married non-Jewish girls. I went out with them. But I suppose the impact of Max Kedushin, plus whatever familial impact I still felt, very much controlled my decisions. When I talk to young people, they don't have any Max Kedushin in their life. And the Jewishness of their family life was not as intellectual as the Jewishness of mine. Yet, as I look at it, my daughter married a convert to Judaism, and I continue to worry about what is the quality of the Judaism that my grandchildren will have. It is one of the major worries of my life. Mm-hmm. Hillel foundations are far more important than they're believed to be. Mm-hmm.
Mark, you went from Tree of Life to Beth Shalom, back to Tree of Life. First, what were the dates, and then, I guess that's not so important. What's up? What was up?
Well, we joined the Tree of Life, at least I think we joined when we first came here. And then we went to Young People's Congregation.
Yes.
And then after Joe Schwartz died, mm-hmm. and I began to think about the importance of supporting a rabbinical establishment, we joined Beth Shulam. Richard Rubenstein was occasionally a sermon giver at Beth Shulam,
mm-hmm.
and I recall that the first time we came into the sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
Rubenstein recognized me, and I was immediately given an aliyah.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, we did join Beth Shulam. The cantor at the time was a rather dissolute young man, a great friend of Morton Rosenbaum, by the name of Burton Kaplan, or Bert Kaplan. Kaplan's dissolute qualities led Beth Shulam to discharge him. Rosenbaum spoke to me of the great injustice of it all, but in short order, Beth Shulam hired Moshe Tovey, whose musicology was a quantum jump over Kaplan's. Tovey is an unusually good cantor. In terms of his personality and personal preferences, he is ultra-conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, I would hardly call him a frustrated opera singer, but he wants the service to focus on his centrality as the spokesman for the congregation, the Shliach Tzibur. I enjoyed his cantorial offerings, although at times I thought he overdid it, that his sense of theater became too rich. Shortly after we joined Beth Shulam, Rabbi Moshe Goldblum, then the rabbi, suggested that I be put on the board of trustees. And for some time I was on the board of trustees. The president of the synagogue in a year or two was David Gold, a local industrialist, and a man of unusual erudition and refined taste. I thought David Gold was unusual, and I believe that the attitude was reciprocated. Gold wanted me very much to become an officer, and in due course I became a vice president and went up the ranks. Gold's successor was Al Smolovar. Smolovar lacked the refinement of David Gold, but on an intellectual level, they were identical. Indeed, if anything, I believe that Smolovar was more informed than Gold. I was a vice president under Smolovar, and there was considerable discussion between Gold and Smolovar about my becoming his successor. Smolovar's wife at that time, Irene, was dying from cancer. The Smolovars and Harriet and Jules Krumen were very close friends. It seemed to me that Harriet Krumen was really the executive officer on the board for Al Smolovar. But Gold did not believe that Beth Shulam was yet ready to have a woman president. When Smolovar completed his term of office, the question was then put to me, would I become president? I felt that it was too soon, because I did not know most of the members of the congregation. In truth, I suppose that nobody knows most of the members of the congregation, but I felt that I was clearly gown, and the members of the congregation were almost totally town. And as the job of the president, as perceived by me, involved considerable fundraising, I thought I ought to get to know the rich people in the congregation before I started pushing them to give money. And so, for that reason, an insurance executive connected to one of the wealthier Jewish families in town, Norton Friedel, became president. While I was vice president, I was usually the chairman of the ritual committee. And in my capacity as chairman of the ritual committee, I had to handle Moshe Talbay and the reforms that the executive committee wished to be considered. The principal one was giving girls their bat mitzvah ceremony on Saturday morning. My own daughter had her bat mitzvah on Friday night, but the congregation took the view that a Saturday morning bat mitzvah for girls should be an established institution. Personally, I have my doubts about it, but my doubts did not relate to the religious issue, but to the psychological one. Girls at 12 or 13 are far more mature than most of the boys are at 13. And I felt that it was hard enough for a boy to be a young man without having him compared as immature to girls his own age. But that doubt, which I expressed freely, did not keep me from trying to conduct appropriately the debate. The debate carried. Let us say the reform carried. Moshe Talbay took this change badly. His personal behavior on the Bima was offensive. He tried to show his dismay at having girls read the Haftorah, often leaving the Bima and coming back only at the end when he sat and made faces. I remember telling Talbay that this was not dignified, particularly for a person like him who was probably one of the half a dozen leading cantors in the world. In other instances, Taube's temper got the best of him, and he said things which I felt were offensive, not to me personally, because he was always very friendly to me, but offensive about other members of the congregation. I remember his telling me that one officer who aspired to a cantorial performance had been, quote, made by me and I will break him, unquote. And I remember saying, Moshe, in the first case, presumably he was made by God. Secondly, if you break him, there are any number of thugs around here who can do the same. You deserve better of our opinion than that. In any event, that reform went through. We also debated the reform of giving women aliyot. That reform did not go through in my time. What did amaze me, however, was that many people were prepared to give women aliyot, but not allow them to be counted in the minyan. There is a theological basis for this. My view, I suppose because I don't derive my arguments from having studied the Talmud under a systematic teacher, my views are usually involve some perception of the society in which we live, a society where women are increasingly accepted as interchangeable with men in terms of legal and moral rights, And also by what I consider to be the instrumentalism of the situation. Instrumentalism means simply the consequences. It seems to me that it is a good thing to have people interested in the synagogue, and if men are not interested in the synagogue sufficiently, and women are, why not let them lead? In any event, when Norton Friedell became a president of the synagogue, it became clear to everyone that the synagogue was now ready to accept a woman as president. And Harriet Truman was his successor. I realized that this took me out of the line of succession, and it bothered me very little. For a while, I retained some committee chairmanship role, but that was soon terminated. The executive director of the synagogue, Mark Stern, was a man of considerable experience and integrity. I found him always very cooperative and a man of very interesting views. He was a concentration camp survivor and took the Holocaust experience as his major consideration. Talbay had also been a concentration camp survivor. Time was to show later on that he was one of the people involved in Schindler's List. Rabbi Moshe Goldblum, however, was not so driven. Goldblum was a very poor speaker. He was a man of unbelievable personal sensitivity, however. I recall that one of my, in my days as department chairman, I had a Jewish secretary, or the department had a Jewish secretary by the name of Betty Katz. Betty's husband suffered from premature senility, and she worked like a Navi, N-A-V-V-Y, that's a British overseas worker, worked very hard. But occasionally would appropriate petty cash from the departmental drawer. She was constantly on the verge of financial exhaustion. And I recall calling Betty in regularly every 3 months and saying, "Betty, put the money back and we'll start anew." Betty had a daughter who was not an easy, well-adjusted child, as I recall. In any event, the husband died. Betty and the daughter took the insurance money and went to Hawaii for a vacation. And if everyone believes that there is a therapeutic value to vacations, that expenditure was justified. Betty came back, had a cancer operation, losing one breast. The daughter got a job at Montefiore Hospital. And miracle of miracles, she became engaged to get married. Unfortunately, Betty's cancer had spread to the other breast. And the story that I tell about Moshe Rosenblum really focuses on this point. Betty was too ill to attend the wedding. The wedding was a private affair in Rabbi Goldblum's study, and I believe it was to be held aus Yontif. I think it must have been Shavuos. And the young man and the daughter, Rosie, arrived at Goldblum's study, and they chatted amicably for 20 or 30 minutes. Goldblum then said, "It is now late enough performed the ceremony," and with good humor he performed the ceremony. They all kissed each other, and then Goldblum said, "I have something sad to tell you. Your mother died an hour ago." And I have always thought that anybody who can pull that kind of an affair off is a man of great resources. Unfortunately, Goldblum needed all of those resources because he had great trouble with his sons. One son became a doctor and there was no problem, but another son became a murderer. It was a major scandal in the city, this made Goldblum's life hell. Now, Goldblum had very little attractiveness to the young people in the congregation, and David Gold and I had decided that it would be very desirable to hire a young rabbi to come in and appeal to the younger members of the congregation, or potential members. Such a rabbi was hired, a graduate of a Reconstructionist seminary in Philadelphia, Paul Reese, I believe it's R-E-I-S. Reese came when Goldblum was away, and I, as chairman of the ritual committee, should have been better able to tell him how to handle the service than I was able to do. Or more accurately, I told him what I thought Goldblum did, but I did not impress upon him the necessity of doing it the same way. The cantor behaved badly towards Reese. Rabbi Goldblum certainly gave him no help. And Reese remained for a period, but he left to go to another congregation in Pittsburgh, taking with him the affections of a great many young people. The idea was, that is to say, Gold's idea was to have Goldblum retire. I was to handle the negotiations with Goldblum, and I told Goldblum the plan, saying that we should have a discussion of his retirement contract, and I thought it would be desirable to have a lawyer, his lawyer, present. Rightly or wrongly, Goldblum, particularly his wife, urged that his son be the lawyer. The son became extraordinarily insulting to both Gould and me. I can well understand the situation. It was a highly emotional one. But what we were trying to say was, we wish to protect your interest because you're going to be pushed out. But the son questioned our integrity, questioned our certainly our loyalty, and most of all questioned our intelligence. The plan fell through. And shortly thereafter, the son was involved in a murder, which was bad enough. Yes. While he was out on bail, he plotted to have the important witness against him murdered. The important witness against him was wired by the police, such that when young Goldberg was eventually sentenced for the first murder, the judge commented that he was the most vicious criminal he had ever had before him. We all supported the efforts of Goldblum to have his son defended. I say we supported by giving money. When it came to the appeal, I was not willing to support with further money. Others were, however. In any event, I remained a member of Beth Sholem, and while Goldblum was, quote, retired, unquote, and his successor, Rabbi Steindl, was voted in. I had known Steindl because he had been a rabbi in the South Hills, and I thought him a good choice. I felt that he would handle the young people situation well, and that was an important consideration. What I did not realize was that Steindl's attitude towards me was ambivalent. I think that his ambivalence had very little to do with me, but it had to do with the attitude of Al Smolovar and Harriet Truman to me. I was in some senses, an embarrassment. I was a passed over obstacle. I cannot really believe that I did anything to irritate them. In any event, at one point Steindl came to me and asked whether I could arrange a speaker for Slichas. And I suggested that as we were having visiting us that time, a rather distinguished professor from Cape Town, Brian Cantor, a committed Jew and one of considerable intelligence, why did he not have Cantor speak? Seindel's answer was, to speak on South Africa, which was a hot topic, Seindel's reply was that Cantor should be one of three speakers. I said that Cantor was too distinguished to share the platform.